For generations, a liberal arts education was the gold standard of preparation for career and a well-rounded life. For much of the last decade, however, voices, including those of prominent technology leaders, have warned that the jobs of today and tomorrow require education in so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Not surprisingly, enrollments in liberal arts fields have declined. But today's guest argues that far more than a luxury, the skills and perspective cultivated by a liberal arts education are precisely the skills needed for the modern information economy. He's Scott Hartley, this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Selve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, filmmakers, authors, journalists, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Scott Hartley, a venture capitalist and former employee of some of America's biggest tech firms, who's also the author of The Fuzzy and the Techie, Why the Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World. Scott, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim.
So let's just start by dispelling any sort of confusion about what are the liberal arts.
Yeah, so the liberal arts, I think, you know, have taken a battering ram over the number of years recently, where, you know, we have this notion that the liberal arts are sort of either liberal or they're just artistic, they're this bygone phenomenon that have no longer relevance in the modern world. Actually, you know, going back to the Latin term artis liberalis, where the term comes from, it's really about the freeing of the mind through sort of the tugging on the mind in different ways, through exposure to a plurality of subjects, including the natural sciences, including things like physics, mathematics, biology. In addition, you know, including things like philosophy, art, history, literature. And so, really, I think as we think about the future, and I'm sure we'll get into this, as we think about the coming, you know, automation, robotics, machine learning, things that we hear and have sort of the pendulum swing toward fear around in the job market, really the thing that gives us a differentiated approach, a differentiated way of thinking, of being creative, being empathetic, all these different functions, come through tugging on the mind in these various ways, exposing a student to a number of different ideas. And that's really, you know, what the liberal arts are all about.
So you mentioned that the reputation of liberal arts has been sort of battered in the last period, a decade or more. And I was looking last night, there's a study from the American Enterprise Institute that says between 2007 and 2016, the overall number of liberal arts and humanities majors declined across the board across the country. Philosophy and religious studies majors down 15%. English language, literature, and composition majors down 22%. History majors down 25%. And it goes on from there. And that's against the backdrop, of, according to their data, of 31% more majors conferred in that same time period across all disciplines. So what explains the lack of popularity or the declining popularity of the liberal arts?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you hear sort of things bandied about in the media. You know, Marco Rubio is famous for saying the market for philosophers is thin. You hear even venture capitalists like Marc Andreessen making comments like, if you have soft skills in the future, you're probably going to work in a shoe store. You know, these are comments that are made sort of off the cuff, but I think, you know, in many ways, education, taking a step back, we have to think about what is, you know, what is the purpose of education? How do we think about how we're preparing our young students and leaders for tomorrow in a world that's rapidly changing? In many ways, we have to prepare for flexibility of mind, flexibility of skills, not sort of a one and done, put the degree on the wall and frame it and believe that we have this sort of carte blanche to relevance in the future. I think where we're seeing a lot of people focus is in this idea that, you know, education is expensive, it's an investment, We often think of education also as an insurance policy. How do we fall back on these skills in 10, 20, 30 years? You know, and then education is also a consumption product. What do we love to study? What do we love to do? And I think we've seen the pendulum in the public sphere swing toward fear so heavily that the mentality around education has become very transactional. And I'm fearful of that because I think that in many ways, the coming waves of automation that will, you know, make inroads into rote and sort of routine skills, in many ways are the things that don't require critical thinking, that are more structured, that are more sort of fact-based rather than pattern-based. So in many ways, some of the things that we study, like accounting, that seem very practical, are maybe the first things that will receive, you know, inroads from sort of machine automation.
So shouldn't education be more than preparation for a job so that you get the best possible job when you come out? I mean, the classic liberal arts were for the betterment also of the individual and for preparation of a citizen who could take part in this country in a democracy. Talk about that. I mean,
yeah,
are those not still important or should they not be important?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we look at technology today and we sort of take a step back and we say, you know, how are these things coming about where there's been a subjugation of privacy, or how are we thinking about First Amendment rights on a platform like Facebook? We're sort of coming to these debates late in the game, if you think about it, right? Why were we not thinking about some of these things ex ante? Why are we only thinking about them today? And I think in many ways, you know, there's a crisis of empathy, there's a crisis of understanding the other, there's a crisis of sort of thinking about who we are as a nation. And these are things that we learn through ecstasis, or standing outside of ourselves, standing in a state of ecstasy that's different from what we know. And we learn these things through something like history. We learn these things through reading literature, putting ourselves in the mind of another, in the time period of another. And I think, you know, as we sort of move to this very transactional belief in education, we've lost some of these things. And I fully agree that, you know, it's not about sort of, in the terms of Stanford University, fuzzies and techies were these kind of jocular terms that go back to the 1970s of, you know, if you were a fuzzy, you studied more of the humanities and the social sciences. If you were a techie, you know, you studied more of the hard sciences and the engineering sciences. And it's really sort of this false opposition, right? It's this false dichotomy going back to 1959 and C.P. Snow and sort of his Two Cultures lecture, where he said, you know, there's this crisis of the sciences on one side of campus and the humanities on the other side of campus. And we have people who read Shakespeare who don't know the first thing about the law of thermodynamics, and people that study biology that have never heard of James Joyce. And how do we sort of bring these two cultures together? And in many ways, whether we call it the sciences or the STEM fields and the humanities, or we call it fuzzies and techies, or we call it ethics and AI, these are the same sort of two cultures that we've got to sort of bring together.
So how do you bring them together at the college level? And then I have a question about before college, but how do you bring them together? Who takes the leadership role in doing that? Or,
you know,
or should?
I think that core curriculum that requires sort of a breadth requirement are important. Interestingly, you know, through the process of writing this book, I've spoken at a number of engineering colleges where they're thinking about these very issues. How do we bring creativity into our engineering students? How do we give them sort of exposure to some of these issues that they may face as, you know, as not just an engineer at a tech company, but maybe as a product manager, maybe as a CEO down the road? You know, how should we be thinking about some of these issues? There's a wonderful young woman who's been quite vocal in this space in thinking about some of these issues. Her name is Tracy Chow, and she was one of the early engineers at a place called Quora. And Quora is a question and answer website. And she realized when she was leading a product team at Quora that many of the people sitting around the table with her had never taken a philosophy class. They'd never taken a class on civil liberties. And as they debated sort of this this moment on the whiteboard where they said, should the product sort of allow users to post whatever they want and then we'll retroactively take down things that are inappropriate, or do we have sort of ground rules at the beginning? It was basically a debate about human nature. It was a debate that you might have in a philosophy 101 class. Yet looking around the table, she said, you know, none of us had really studied those issues. None of us had thought about First Amendment rights. And that was something where she really started pushing the envelope on blended teams and blended sort of education and thinking about How do we have engineers who are also versed in philosophy and vice versa?
So MIT comes to mind as a school that is doing some of that. We had a guest on last year, Alan Lightman, who is a very distinguished astrophysicist and also a humanities expert, a humanist.
What's fascinating, I think, as you get into the nuance of any subject matter, you read Carlo Rovelli, book on cosmology, and you realize that you may go through, you know, cosmological astrophysics, but you come back around to philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. You may read an E.O. Wilson book about, the life of ants in very binary systems, mm-hmm. But you realize that there are learnings about that come back to AI. So you have a biologist informing a process around artificial intelligence, and you have a cosmologist thinking about philosophical issues. And I think that when we compartmentalize campuses into the sciences on one side of campus with one major and the humanities on the other side of campus, we really sort of silo this thinking around, you know, thinking about our education as a plane ticket to either a relevant destination or an irrelevant destination, where we can put a piece of paper in a frame on the wall and we can claim sort of future relevance or not future relevance. And I think we need to move away from this sort of one and done notion, thinking about our education in the engineering term of a life in beta, right? We're always in beta, we're always a work in progress, regardless of, you know, if you graduated 10, 20, 30 years ago, what can you continue to push the envelope on? What can you continue to learn? And thinking about, how we build out our own educational practices as a passport, where we think about collecting stamps from various walks of life, from various parts of the world, various sort of academic domains. So if I'm somebody who's studied political theory and international relations, how can I sort of up my game as somebody who thinks about data science, as somebody who maybe has some basic ability to converse with engineers about computer code? I think that's really important, not to sort of become the full stack developer necessarily, but can you become a full stack integrator where you can kind of assemble some of these pieces and parts?
Is the argument, so when we talk about sort of a core curriculum at the university level right now, we're talking about providing students with a level of literacy. Not mastery of the great questions of philosophy, but literacy, exposure to them so that they can understand and they can think for themselves when they encounter similar issues wherever they might arise in the rest of their life. Mm-hmm. Is that the kind of level of sophistication you're talking about ought to be ingrained across curriculums?
It's a good question. I mean, there is clearly an argument for expertise, deep expertise in a field like philosophy. I think there's also an argument for sort of applied philosophical concepts and questions to the very debates of the era. So, you know, whether or not, I think it's about following your passion as a student. It's about thinking about it in terms of these three frameworks of, you know, education is expensive. It is an investment. How do you sort of put your time to use in the best way possible? You know, how do you think about where the world is moving and have a thesis on where you think your skills need to be in 10, 20, 30 years? And think about it in terms of an insurance policy. But at the same time, think about it in terms of what you love, right? What is it that you really want to study? And if it is philosophy all the way down, like Stuart Butterfield, the founder of Slack, he has 2 degrees in philosophy, just like Reid Hoffman, who founded LinkedIn, just like Peter Thiel, who founded Palantir and PayPal. So, you know, some of these philosophers that have gone all the way down, Stuart Butterfield really attributes his ability as an entrepreneur to grapple with ambiguity, to grapple in the gray area of life, which is something that you learn through not having a right and wrong answer necessarily, through studying something like philosophy. So I think, you know, to become an expert, there isn't a degree title called philosophy and a job title called, you know, philosophy in Silicon Valley. Right. Of course, you can become a professor. But there is a job called CEO or product manager, right? And so we have this notion that we need to accord degree titles with job titles. And of course, the path of life is curved, and we all sort of have a meandering story. And it's about sort of how we train ourselves for grit and resilience and flexibility of mind, and the ability to sort of adapt through the changing world that will come.
And the idea, though, that you have to get students in particular, and I think to some degree, often their parents, too, to think beyond equating the major with what they're going to do for the rest of their lives, it's a challenge, because I think people are just sort of, you know, almost conditioned to think that way. Mm-hmm. But so the book is The Fuzzy and the Techie, Why the Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World. And, you know, this is a provocative read on a lot of different levels, but one of the things that I came away from this is that the operative word in the title is the word and. It's yes. not that the liberal arts or the techies, it's both, right?
Absolutely.
Can you build on that for us?
So, you know, the premise of the liberal arts ruling the digital world, I think when we think about what happened, let's say, in the 90s, there were sort of the build-out of infrastructure and technology. And, of course, today we're seeing the build-out of infrastructure and technology in things like blockchain, right? But what we're also seeing is the application of technology to every different walk of life, every different domain, every different geography. And so when you think of some of the biggest opportunities happening today,
we need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at J.M. Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Scott Hartley, a graduate of Stanford University, where he studied political science before beginning a career that has taken him to Google, Facebook, Harvard University, and the White House as a Presidential Innovation Fellow. He's the author of The Fuzzy and the Techie, Why the Liberal Arts Will Rule the Digital World. On Twitter, he's at Scott E. Hartley, H-A-R-T-L-E-Y.
Their technology applied to a particular market, to a particular skill set, to a particular thesis about the world, where oftentimes what gives you a comparative advantage as an entrepreneur, as somebody building one of these companies, is understanding the world around you and understanding how to apply some of the most meaningful technology to something that you see in the world. And so, you know, not to sort of make the liberal arts subservient to the marketability, right? Because it is about training a person to become a broad citizen and a thinker and somebody who can contribute to society and ask the right questions. And I think that that's something that we also, you know, can't lose sight of. But there is very much a marketability and very much sort of an opportunity, I think, for students who can become conversant in technology, that can become conversant in the basics of being a techie, but can also think about the world around them and apply that technology. And you see this over and over again. There's a company in Silicon Valley called Keep Truckin'. Keep Truckin' it's an electronic logging device that plugs into a truck. We think of, you know, Elon Musk and the sort of the coming wave of automation and how all trucks are going to disappear off the highways in America. In actuality, you know, the turnover of capital stock will take generations. Truck drivers are aging out of the market while new people are entering the market. There is this opportunity where Shoaib Makhani, the founder, understood that his grandfather in Pakistan had come from a background in trucking. He had observed, sort of as a political science student at the University of Texas at Austin, he had observed sort of regulatory change and what he thought was coming in Washington around more safety measures on trucks. And he sort of built this company around where he thought the market was going. Not sort of the 20-year fear solution, which is that all trucks are disappearing, but the 5-year solution, which is we have to make trucks safer for drivers and for people on the roads. And you know, fast forward 5 years, he's built a $1.6 billion company with a political science degree, sitting in Silicon Valley. And he's a case in point, just like many of these other entrepreneurs, about how you can take some of these tools and a vision for where you think the world is going and really create your own opportunities.
So what are some of the other companies that blend or attempt to blend fuzzy and techie? I'm thinking Facebook. Their deep knowledge of human behavior and how they appeal to people. Is that another company where this is happening? The blending of liberal arts and the tech side?
What's interesting about the phenomenon when we talk about the opportunity for jobs, let's say as a psychologist, right? There are ample opportunities for you to work in Silicon Valley with a psych degree. Take, for example, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's sister, Randy Zuckerberg, was a psychology major. Mark himself studied psychology, obviously didn't graduate. But we think of him as sort of a uniform coder that had this, you know, pure technical ability, But in actuality, it was a sociological insight. It was an observation about what was needed in society. So in many ways, both the opportunity for a liberal arts major to work in Silicon Valley is the double-edged sword of how some of these technologies are coming to influence our own behavior, right? If we think about a Twitter notification or a red dot that pops up on our phone, oftentimes we think of this as just sort of a happenstance occurrence. In actuality, I mean, these are the types of things that are A/B tested by roomfuls of engineers, thinking about things like how B.F. Skinner in the 1950s thought about variable reward structures and what leads somebody to have somewhat addictive behavior, right? So these are things that are not happening sort of by happenstance, but technology is sort of driven by the values and the things that we are optimizing for in those technology companies. And so I think as citizens, if we can sort of educate each other as citizens to think critically, to, as Voltaire said, judge somebody by their questions, not by their answers, these are the types of questions we should be asking, that technology is not agnostic. It's reflective of the values of the people building those technologies. So how do we, as citizens, push back, whether it's through regulation, whether it's through sort of asking the right questions, whether it's through our own use and adaptation to terms of service, but how do we as people exhibit our own agency, right? And I think, so in many ways, these are the double-edged swords of both the opportunity for a liberal arts student in Silicon Valley, but also sort of the ramifications of using technologies to nudge human behavior
in
different ways.
Shouldn't this begin in childhood, really? In today's world, children, and certainly by the time you're in grammar school or a little bit into grammar school, you've got some type of device. And then by the time you hit middle school, and certainly by high school, you're on Facebook, you're on Twitter, you're doing all. Shouldn't there be a role for parents and educators and others to do what you're saying here?
One of the most interesting trends that you see in Silicon Valley are some of the leaders of the largest technology companies actually send their children to Waldorf schools, where
Explain
they're technology
what that means.
Free. So where you don't interact with technology, they're sort of analog only for
really?
The first
Isn't
number of years. And I think that there is something to say about sort of walking the middle path. You know, it's not to say that we should shun technology. There are many things about again, as technology is reflective of human values, there are so many ways we can nudge behavior in a positive way, right? We can think about a company like Omada Health, for example, that tries to reduce the propensity for type 2 diabetes by getting somebody more active. If you can reduce body mass index, you can reduce the propensity for diabetes. So something like a nudge that gets you off the couch through an intervention on your phone is a positive, potentially, intervention. Yet maybe a notification on a social media app that draws you in to stare at your phone while you're in line at Starbucks, it takes away from that moment of spontaneity where you talk to your neighbor.
But that alert works, though, because I have to tell you, it pops up
work.
And there you go.
So in the notion of, how do we sort of blend familiarity with technology with, I think, in early childhood education, there are no shortcuts. You know, in some ways, analog devices, learning, mastering a foreign language, mastering a musical instrument, reading Tolstoy, these are things that have immutable properties where we have to subject ourselves to the properties of these analog devices. They're not there to entertain us. They're there for us to grapple with. They're there to change who we are. And I think that there is this tug of war between sort of the lean back methodology of technology and sort of the lean in approach of dealing with analog devices and sort of the depth of rigor required to master some of these things. And that's where we learn grit, that's where we learn empathy, and those are the things that can't be shortcutted with technology and a ding and a notification.
You know, so you talked about the power of our devices to nudge human behavior and the apps that we're running on them. We've seen this in recent electoral history, we've seen this in our consumer behavior. Fundamentally though, these are moral exercises. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of curious about sort of the bringing of those moral debates and those moral considerations into the tech firms themselves, mm-hmm. to grapple with what burden, what obligation do they have to the society that they are a part of?
It's what's so interesting is I think there is an inflection point. And I don't know exactly where this line is, but if you go back to the 2006, 2007 Facebook office, you would see sort of mottos painted on the wall that said 1% done. It's a positive motto. Also, a hacker motto, which has been sort of ridiculed in the public sphere about move fast and break things, yeah. Right? Obviously, as a young 20s hacker culture, trying to build something, trying to make a startup successful, that was something that at one point was a commendable motto. Obviously, once it gets to the point of inflection where you're working with Anderson Cooper, you're on CNN, you're dealing with actual electoral issues, suddenly the motto move fast and break things doesn't sound so good. And so again, where are these lines of responsibility? And who's sort of pushing these lines of responsibility? And somebody who's done a great job, I think, of being sort of the modern day Diogenes, walking around, a Diogenes would walk around Athens with a lamp during the day looking for an honest man. He's sort of the father of cynicism in some ways. And I think that somebody that's doing this in a great way around Silicon Valley is a guy named Tristan Harris. And Tristan really sort of posed these questions at Google by saying, what are our responsibilities where we have 10 people who may come from the same school, have the same socioeconomic background, live in the same city in America, who are making micro determinations about a button on Google.com that has implications that may save somebody or cost somebody 5 seconds of their day. But you multiply that by a billion, and at some point of scale, is there public responsibility? Is there a responsibility that is moral, ethical? How should we be thinking about diversity on these teams, both intellectual diversity and thinking about new ideas and other forms of diversity? And I think by posing these questions, he really shined a light in some ways on the tech companies to begin thinking about these issues, and I think informed the public to begin asking some of these questions.
We've got about a minute left. I'm curious about what role you think public policy ought to play in either encouraging this marriage between the fuzzy and the techie, or just thinking about the regulatory issues more broadly written in the tech sector.
I think there have been some great programs that sort of are attempting to merge these two worlds. Under President Obama, the Presidential Innovation Fellows Program,
which you were one,
which brought people from Silicon Valley, oftentimes techies, into Washington to kind of infuse a different type of thinking. I think we saw when Mark Zuckerberg went to Congress to testify, both sort of the need for perhaps greater sort of philosophical inquiry and questioning about the platforms, questions around First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights, perhaps with unreasonable search and seizure of your data, right, on one front. And then we also saw concurrently the real need for technical education in a place like Congress. And so, we are sort of running both sides of this.
Scott Hartley, the book is The Fuzzy and the Techie. Thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Storing the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pelscenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. He's Wayne, I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Storing the Public Square.